Part of this thing is that it's unrelenting. Part of it is that it happens so fast. And part of it, yeah, is that it's scary. But there is work to do and things to be understood. So, from American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday today, the 20th day of March. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Here is a thought as we begin. Maybe this will be useful to you, maybe not, but it is where I am right now. Time kind of doesn't have an economic meaning at the moment. I mean, yes, days go by, the virus spreads, but this economy, or really big chunks of it anyway, is shutting down. And if the economy is shutting down, does time have any economic meaning? Which, even as I say that out loud, I understand is a little bit bleak. So let's not go there, shall we? Let us deal instead with what is right in front of us, which is, and I think this is the technical term, economically unbelievable. Neela Richardson is at Edward Jones. Kate Davidson is at The Wall Street Journal. Hey, everybody.
Hi.
So, Neela, let me start with you on a cell phone, obviously, for appropriate social distancing reasons. I heard you, I think it was CNBC this morning, right?
That's right. Yeah.
And you said at one point, we have not yet figured out what the worst of this is. Discuss.
Well, if you look at the most recent batch of economic data, it's all been pretty good. I mean, we've gotten really bad data out of China, but domestically speaking, the U.S. labor market looked strong in February, and those initial conditions were strong and in place. But over the last 2 weeks, we've seen a complete deterioration in the normal course of life. The fact that we're all sitting in these home offices, not going to bars and restaurants, not going to movie theaters, not going to sporting events, not traveling, not going on cruises, has a huge economic impact that we haven't seen play out in the data, and we haven't seen play out in terms of corporations' earnings estimates.
Right.
For this year. And as that data rolls in, we'll have a better understanding of the real toll, not just the human toll, which is great, but the economic toll of this pandemic.
Kate, we got a number from Goldman Sachs either yesterday afternoon or today. Their latest estimate for GDP, I would say growth, but GDP collapse is really the number. First quarter was like -6% growth or something. And then second quarter, which is the quarter that starts on April the 1st, they're predicting, Goldman Sachs is, the guys who study this stuff there, 24% to the downside on gross domestic product growth. What do you even do with that number? How do you wrap your brain around it?
Yeah, it's like talking about the federal debt, right? $23 trillion.
Right,
like, what does
right,
that even mean?
Right.
We can't. It's really hard to, I think, understand and translate and even anticipate what that will look like. I guess it looks like literally everyone staying inside their houses, you know,
yeah.
Like Neela just said, no one going shopping, no one going out to dinner, nobody going on vacation. It's just the everything grinding to a halt at once. We think back to 2008, 2009, and a couple weeks ago, people were making comparisons to that. And some people were saying, you know, that's really, we're not there yet. And it's just quite amazing how in 2 weeks, everyone's thinking, not only are we there, but is a very good chance it'll be worse than that. And then, obviously, a lot of that downturn was spread out over many months.
Yeah.
And this is just happening instantaneously. And so I think that's where you can, when you think of it that way, you kind of see where that dramatic drop off, how that can happen.
Right, exactly. So Neela, talk to me then about that duration part of it, and specifically as it relates to the $1 trillion bailout that is being bandied about on Capitol Hill. This is, of course, Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell's bill, $1 trillion plus maybe a little bit. Last number I heard was that it was $1,200 to individuals and $2,400 for a couple, which in Los Angeles will not cover rent, let alone help things stabilize.
It's a step. It's going to be, time will tell, and you say that time is uncertain and time has no meaning, but time will tell whether this is actually impactful for the economy. I mean, this was tried during the 2008 financial crisis, giving some kind of funds to households. what happened is that a lot of people just ended up saving that money. The more targeted the funds, the more impactful they are. But if people can't go anywhere and can't spend it on anything, it's going to be hard to see how that money goes back into the real economy. And yes, unless it's targeted for people to help pay basic living expenses like the rent. Even in Los Angeles, maybe half the rent.
Yeah, yeah. Kate, let me ask you this. And I know the answer before I ask this question, but why is Congress and the White House dithering on getting this done? I mean, we can see the damage happening in real time.
I think they're just trying to catch up. I honestly think, as I was saying, a couple weeks ago, people really, even though you could see it in China, then you could see it in Italy. Yeah. I think, again, it was just so hard to grasp how real that was. And so we heard plenty of people saying 2 weeks ago, you need to pass something to send checks to people right now. But there was this view, and there's still a view to some extent that, right, targeted relief is important, sending stuff to people who need it most. But now I think that the conversation is shifting a little bit where, right, Congress is kind of dithering a little bit. Yeah, I mean, they're moving quickly for Congress, but they're dithering a little bit over, making sure we don't give this to billionaires and millionaires and people who don't need it. There's a growing chorus of people saying, just send it and we'll figure that out later. We'll claw that back through taxes, when people file next year. Let's not wait. Let's just do this.
Kate Davidson at The Wall Street Journal. Neela Richardson at Edward Jones. Thanks, you two.
Thanks, Kai.
Thank you, Kai.
All right. Stay safe out there. On Wall Street today, well, the good news is the markets are going to be closed for 48 hours. The bad news is they're going to open again in 48 hours. We will have the details when we do the numbers. Indicator number one of how bad this crisis is going to be is going to come next Thursday when we get the number for what's called first-time claims for unemployment. We've been calling a whole bunch of people about their coronavirus experiences over the past week or so, people who have suddenly lost work. Here they are.
My name is Nora Alexander.
My name is Anna Brand.
My name is Andy Datesman.
I'm a cosmetologist. I was working at Great Clips.
I am a Spanish to English interpreter.
And I'm a New York stage manager.
With the public schools closed, our work is gone.
Pretty much all of my foreseeable income is up in the air.
I'm currently now unemployed.
I do have savings, so I'll be able to bridge it, but it's going to be tight.
The first month will feel okay. I'm not sure how the second month will feel, and I know that that's luckier than most right now.
I mean, I still have bills every week that I have to pay. I make a big difference in my family because I'm one of the only people working, so like a month being off or longer, I mean, I don't know what I would do.
You know, I need my savings. So my son wants to go to graduate school. He wants to be a lawyer. So if I start living off of that money, we're going to have trouble paying for his college.
This week, thinking ahead, I had to pick between my prescribing psych and just my regular therapist because spending $200 each per appointment this week is just not, I think, the best idea.
Nobody knows how long this is going to last, you know?
I'm looking forward to what's going to be certainly tightened belts.
That was Nora Alexander in New York City, Andy Datesman in Walpole, Massachusetts, Anna Brand in Bakersfield, California. You can tell us about your coronavirus economy at marketplace.org. If this is Friday, and it is, I'll bet you've got questions about what's going on in this economy right now, because, I mean, come on, right? Send them to us. I'm on Twitter, at Kai Rizdahl. There is a link also on our website, marketplace.org. Here's question number one.
Hey, Kai. My name is Ty Patton in Omaha, Nebraska, and I have a question for Marketplace. I see some people on Facebook and other places equating the Fed's cash infusion with the bailout of Wall Street during the last crisis. I don't believe it's the same, but it's all very confusing. Any help with this would be great. Thank you.
All right. Good question. And no, they are not the same thing. Back in the financial crisis, after Lehman Brothers collapsed, Henry Paulson, who was then the Secretary of the Treasury, used a bunch of the $700 billion in TARP money. That's the Troubled Asset Relief Program, if you remember that, right? to inject new capital into the big Wall Street banks to make sure they had enough cash to keep operating. Paulson has said on this program that he did it to keep the economy from collapsing. Others, of course, disagree. We honestly don't have enough airtime to have that debate right now. What the Federal Reserve did last week, when it put $1.5 trillion into a very particular slice of the financial system, the overnight big bank lending markets, well, that was different. First of all, it's money that's on the Fed's balance sheet. It's not actual cash that gets added to the national debt. And number two, it's not like the Fed just said, hey, big banks, here's $1.5 trillion. Go to town. The Fed has lent some portion of that money out, yes, and in return, the banks handed over the highest possible quality collateral they had, U.S. Treasury bonds. This is a totally confusing one, I get that, but what the Fed did a week ago on what the 2008 bailout was of the big banks, they are not the same thing. We are still, believe it or not, way in the early days of this crisis, and how the government responds once it is finally responding in full will depend in great measure on what tools it has. Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin said last week that he thinks he and other regulators are going to need more tools than they have right now, tools that were taken away after the financial crisis. MarketPlace's Sabri Benishore has more.
After the Great Recession, there was a backlash. People were upset that the Fed had come to the rescue of some firms outside the banking system, but not others. So Dodd-Frank took away some of that power and created a new rule that said the Fed can't pick and choose who gets help.
Roughly speaking, they have to give it to everybody or nobody.
John Cochran is a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution. He says the idea was to prevent the Fed from getting sucked down into the mucky, dirty business of picking winners and losers. And he gives this example.
Suppose that airlines are going to get in trouble. There will be an airline bailout package, and there will be a populist backlash to that. The Federal Reserve should not be the one making that call if it's going to stay a politically independent technocratic agency.
Better, he says, for politicians to make those kinds of decisions. Donald Lamson disagrees. He's a lawyer and an independent consultant who worked on parts of Dodd-Frank. He says Congress went too far in hamstringing the Fed.
This was one of the major mistakes that Congress made.
He says he'd rather have experts at the Fed decide whether a company needs help and says they can do so quickly. Daryl Duffy agrees. He's a professor of finance at Stanford's Graduate School of Business, and he gives this example.
Suppose some individual non-bank were to get into serious trouble financially, and were it to fail, it would create a real crater on the economy.
Under current rules, the Fed would not be able to step in. Can't help one company, gotta help them all.
The Fed would just have to sit on its hands until this developed into a more significant crisis and multiple firms were in trouble.
The new coronavirus and efforts to contain it threaten to take down industries and firms, and some will need emergency loans. The issue of whether to return power to the Fed is ultimately about who's going to pick who gets that help, who's going to hand it out, and how quickly they can do it. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
We heard a little bit ago from people who have lost their jobs or had their hours cut because of this crisis, and that is terrible for them, to be clear. But for people running businesses, there can be an economic and emotional toll as well.
My name is Brian Noonan. My wife and I live in New Haven, Connecticut. We own 2 3-family homes rigged up as Airbnb apartments.
My name is Jeanette Harney, and I'm the operations director for Cacao Cafe and 415 Westlake, an event space and coffee shop in South Lake Union in the heart of Seattle.
My name is Michael Alexander. I am the owner and operator of the 9 Round in downtown LA. The franchise is a 30-minute full-body kickboxing workout circuit program.
It was a devastating time to have to let go staff.
We were using this as a kind of retirement fund. We are vulnerable to the virus. So far, we've been lucky. In our apartments, we now have 5 traveling nurses. So they're usually careful.
I can't hug you. I can't do anything but say, I'm really sorry your job is no longer here until there's a neighborhood to serve coffee to.
My first day of opening was February 19th. And here we are. It's scary because I had to tell my employees, file unemployment.
That was Brian Noonan. He's in New Haven, Connecticut. Jeanette Harney is in Seattle. Michael Alexander is here in Los Angeles. Coming up.
Yesterday, I took the day to mail birthday cards to any of my students who have birthdays in the coming weeks.
An act of kindness from a teacher in Milwaukee. But before that feel-good moment, because we have to, let's do the numbers. All right, here you go. The Dow Industrial's off 913 points today, 4.5%, 19,173. The NASDAQ down 271 points, 3.7%, 6879. The S&P 500 down 104 points, 4.3%, finished at 2304. For the 5 days gone by, obviously, the three major indices posted their biggest drop since October 2008. Of course, the peak of the financial crisis. This week, the Dow down 17%, the NASDAQ down 12%, the S&P 500 down 15%. A little bit of good news, actually, in the travel sector. Hertz up 23% today. Carnival Cruise Lines up 20%. Royal Caribbean banked 6% today. Bond prices rose. Yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 0.87%. You're listening to Marketplace.
I'm Rima Khreis, host of Marketplace's podcast, This is Uncomfortable. This week, the coronavirus pandemic felt like it went from this thing in the headlines to something inescapable. It's hard not to know someone who's being impacted in a really serious way. I mean, just the other day, my sister told me that she was let go.
I felt like I kind of like failed because I'm like laid off. I didn't do anything wrong. And so when I got that, I was just like, crap, I'm out of a job. Like, what do I do?
On the show, we get into coping with COVID-19. Episode drops every Thursday. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. There is perhaps no business or economic phrase more familiar to the general public in this country than too big to fail, other than maybe bailout, right? So as Congress and the White House continue to hammer out the details of the $1 trillion relief package, one question is what kind of strings ought to be attached to any corporate bailout money. Democrats and their allies are pushing for a ban on share buybacks as a condition of any assistance. A lot of Republicans say they are opposed to limits on buybacks, although President Trump said yesterday he would be okay with such a condition. Fact is, though, that after the GOP's 2017 tax cuts, companies spent billions of dollars buying back their own stock at the expense of making other investments. So Marketplace's Amy Scott explains the 2020 version of the bailout buyback debate.
On the Senate floor earlier this week, Minority Leader Chuck Schumer summed up the backlash.
One of the reasons, let's not forget, that many airlines are so short of cash right now is they spent billions on stock buybacks. Money they had to send out when they should have been saving it for a rainy day.
In the last decade, according to Bloomberg, the big U.S. airlines spent more than 95% of their free cash flow buying back their own shares. Companies do this to boost their stock price and reward shareholders and executives who get paid more when shares are worth more. Airlines aren't alone. Irene Tung is a senior researcher at the National Employment Law Project.
In most industries, a majority of companies are spending more than 50% of their profits on buybacks. And that's sort of a central weakness of the U.S. economy right now as we go into this economic downturn.
Not just because companies don't have enough rainy day funds, but because their workers don't.
If companies had been paying workers more, then people wouldn't be living paycheck to paycheck, you know, the way that they are now, leaving them as vulnerable as they are when all of a sudden that paycheck disappears.
But buybacks don't just enrich shareholders and company executives. Rick Marshall researches corporate governance at MSCI.
The money goes out to investors who, by and large, are reinvesting this in other companies. This is all money that's returning back into the larger economy.
Charles Elson teaches governance at the University of Delaware. He says the blame on buybacks is misplaced.
And even had you not bought any stock back, you would never have had enough cash on hand to support the kinds of revenue declines that we're seeing. You're talking 60, 70% decline in revenue. That's catastrophic.
And he says, unlike the bank bailouts during the financial crisis, this particular catastrophe wasn't the company's fault. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
About that last line from Amy, about companies not being at fault for this present economic catastrophe, that is totally true. They are not. But we can't pretend the past couple of 5 years in this economy hasn't happened. Boeing has bought back $43 billion worth of its shares since 2013, money that could have come in handy right now as the company leads the charge for a $60 billion aerospace industry bailout. The argument being made is that Boeing is critically important to the American economy and that if it collapses, that would be felt all through American manufacturing. Marketplace's Jack Stewart took a look at whether Boeing really is too big to fail.
You know how sometimes the more opinions you ask for, well, the more different opinions you get? Not in this case.
In my opinion, yes, I think it is too big to fail.
The industry is too big to fail. Boeing, of course, is a key part of that.
Yes, that's absolutely correct. It is too big to fail.
Let's start with the last voice you just heard. That was Bijan Vasir at Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University. He says Boeing's importance to the U.S. economy can't be overstated.
Air transportation, including aircraft manufacturing, if it was a country, was the fifth biggest economy in the world.
Boeing is a huge part of that, along with its suppliers. Richard Aboulafia is an aviation analyst at Thiel Group.
The bulk of the jobs involved are actually in the supply chain. It's tremendously complicated to build a jetliner, and there are lots of individual subcontractors, each with their own workforces.
He says, take the 737 MAX, for example. The body comes from Spirit Aerosystems in Wichita, Kansas. GE builds the engines in Evendale, Ohio, along with a French company. And Boeing is also a space and defense company, building everything from fighter jets to a new spacecraft designed to take astronauts to the International Space Station.
They are a huge provider of government services.
Arthur Wheaton is with the Worker Institute at Cornell. Boeing employs around 150,000 people directly, but in its call for government support, it says it relies on the broader aerospace industry with 2.5 million jobs. Wheaton says it's important to protect that specialized, highly trained workforce.
If you start shutting Boeing down, you start losing those employees, you start laying them off, then you could be hurting by decades the capacity of the United States to start building other planes when things or if things pick up.
Boeing is America's biggest exporter, and Wheaton says that just strengthens the argument that it is too big to fail. I'm Jack Stewart for Marketplace.
How about question number two?
This is Sid Stoll from Orlando, Florida. When will we know that we're moving back to normal? Is there an indicator we should follow or an announcement we should wait for? We all seem to be waiting for the light at the end of the tunnel without knowing what the light actually is.
So this is a good one because, A, there is going to be an end to this, and it's important to remember that. But also, number two, while we might be able to get good and near real-time data on the virus, we are not going to know that we're moving back to economic normal until we are well on our way. And here's what I mean. Think back to the crisis again, okay? Lehman Brothers collapsed in September of 2008. The market didn't bottom out until March of 2009. And we didn't find out until September of 2009 that the recession had officially ended in June. So, all of that said, if you want one thing to keep an eye on, look at jobs for sure, the unemployment rate. If we have learned anything this week, and it's a lesson that is going to have to keep on giving, honestly, it's that there can still be a lot of good happening out there. So here are some of the ways people have been trying to make all this better.
My name is Yia Vang, chef and owner of Union Hmong Kitchen here in Minneapolis, Minnesota.
My name is Jocelyn Diaz. I live in Longwood, Florida, and I'm a freelancer mostly. I do production work, so I run camera for concerts.
My name is Jennifer Koss. I'm from Milwaukee, and I currently teach high school English. I'm looking for ways to just brighten people's days a little bit. Yesterday, I took the day to mail birthday cards to any of my students who have birthdays in the coming weeks.
So my roommate, he's already told me that, you know, if I can't make rent, then not to really worry about it. So he's been really understanding about it. It's really cool.
We had a family who got in contact with us, and they said, hey, we want to use you as a caterer for our son's bar mitzvah. And it was, you know, it was super cool. And right after they got done paying for it, literally the next day they called and they said, we actually don't want the money back. What we really want to do is we want you to be able to take care of your guys.
That was Ia Vong of the Union Hmong Kitchen in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Jennifer Koss, she is a teacher in Milwaukee. And Jacqueline Diaz, she's a stage production freelancer in Longwood, Florida. This final note on the way out today to be added to the list of things that, despite our best efforts, just are not making sense right now. Maybe you saw this already, but the Tampa Bay Buccaneers are going to pay Tom Brady, it has been reported, $60 million to play football for 2 years. Don't at me here, but first of all, come on, $60 million for 2 years? Also, this is kind of like Joe Montana in a Chiefs jersey, right? Or going way back, Joe Namath. Playing for the Rams? All right, we're done. The Dow off 913 points today, 4.5%. The NASDAQ down 271 points, 3.7%. The S&P 500 off 104 points, 4.3%. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Nancy Cassett is the managing director of news. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you Monday, everybody. Have a great weekend. And look, wash your hands, stay safe, stay apart. It's important, right? This is APM.